Talking Europe.
Talking Europe.
Talking Europe.
Talking Europe.
Talking Europe.
Talking Europe. A podcast by the European Democracy Institute in collaboration with Europa Podcast.
Welcome to the Europa Podcast. This episode is part of our Talking Europe series. My name is Manuel, and I'm delighted that you're listening today.
When you live in a democracy, the costs of opposing the government should essentially be close to zero. The way to understand American populist authoritarianism is that it's not particularly popular. It's just very powerful. Corruption is a mobilizing issue of citizens against authoritarianism.
Says Daniel Seeblatt, Eton Professor of Government at the Harvard University. In this episode, you will hear a recording of the event Democracy in Danger, an evening with Daniel Seeblatt, recorded on May 6, 2026, at the Heinrich Böll Foundation in Berlin. The event was part of the series Writing Democracies, Stories, Ideas and Arguments on and off the page, a cooperation between Bard College Berlin and the Heinrich Böll Foundation. The evening focused on the question of where and why democracies are coming under pressure today. The discussion addressed the United States under Donald Trump, the concept of competitive authoritarianism, Viktor Orban's Hungary, democratic institutions, the media, courts, and the question of how democratic societies can respond to authoritarian strategies. The evening was opened by Eva van der Ragt on behalf of the Heinrich Böll Foundation. The conversation was moderated by Joshua Jaffa, writer-in-residence at Bard College Berlin and contributing writer for The New Yorker. His guest was Professor Daniel Seeblatt, who is also director of the Minder de Günzburg Center for European Studies and, together with Stephen Levitsky, author of the books How Democracy Die and Tyranny of the Minority. You will now hear the recording of the conversation. The recording ends before the audience Q&A. Thank you for joining us, and we hope this conversation offers both insights and encouragement at a time when democracy needs our attention.
Good evening. On behalf of the Heinrich Böll Foundation, I am delighted to welcome our distinguished guests, Daniel Seeblatt, Eton Professor of Government at Harvard University, and Joshua Jaffa, writer-in-residence at Bard College Berlin and contributing writer at The New Yorker. Welcome to our foundation and thank you very much for joining us today to discuss where and why our democracies are in danger. This event is part of the series Writing Democracies, Stories, Ideas and Arguments on and off the page, organized by the Bard College Berlin and the Heinrich Böll Foundation. I would like to thank Florian Becker and Berit Ebert from Bard College Berlin for their excellent cooperation. They are over there. It's great to have you here with us. Thank you. From the perspective of renowned journalists and writers, our joint series offers a wider exploration of democracy and democratic institutions, including politics and society in the US and Europe, the lessons of history, the role of democratic values and misconceptions on both sides of the Atlantic. Our aim is to strengthen transatlantic dialogue during these extremely difficult times. In 2018, Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Seeblatt wrote in their groundbreaking bestseller, How Democracies Die, I quote, "History doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. The promise of history and the hope of this book is that we can find the rhymes before it is too late." 7 years later, Trump was reelected, and 1 year into his second term, we are overwhelmed by the speed and scale of the uncertainty, turmoil, and disruption that the Trump administration confronts us with on a daily basis. Yet, it is not only in the United States, but also in Europe, that democratic norms are eroding and democratic institutions are being undermined. Democracy is under enormous pressure worldwide. At the same time, it is not too late to look for the rhymes. And there are glimmers of hope. For example, in Hungary, where history was made on 12 April this year for the country and for Europe. The electorate's desire for a democracy based on freedom and the rule of law proved stronger than the inhuman and cynical power politics of Viktor Orban, who began transforming the country into an autocratic and highly corrupt state 16 years ago. His authoritarian governance was directed against liberal democracy, its institutions, his political opponents, civil society organizations, and the independent media. Among the cornerstones of Orbanism were the stoking of fear and a destructive energy, cultural wars, scapegoating and disinformation campaigns aimed at dividing society. The relief and sense of liberation following the political breakthrough could be seen and felt on election night in the festive atmosphere, in the chants of Europe, and in the joyful faces of the many people on the streets. The Orban regime has served as a blueprint for anti-liberal governments worldwide. Its Fidesz party has played a leading role in European and transatlantic far-right networks for years. Orban's defeat calls into question their confidence in victory, as well as their policies and strategies. Peter Madias' TISA party now has the two-thirds majority required to amend the constitution, which gives it the opportunity to restore democracy in Hungary. After 16 long years, this will be anything but an easy task. Democratic forces must learn the right lessons from the rise and fall of the Orban system. To conclude, I'd like to read a poem by Amanda Gorman that might inspire us and help us to discover the rhymes of history. Every day we are learning. Every day we are learning how to live with essence, not ease, how to move with haste, never hate, how to leave this pain that is beyond us, behind us. Just like a skill or any art, we cannot possess hope without practicing it. It is the most fundamental craft we demand of ourselves. I am now looking forward to our discussion and would like to hand over to our moderator, Joshua Yaffa, who is also the driving force behind this joint project. Thank you, Joshua, for your inspiring work, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Eva, for that generous introduction. Thanks to everyone for coming tonight, and thanks most of all for Daniel Ziblatt joining me on stage. I'll introduce Daniel more fully in just a moment. While I have the privilege of holding the microphone, I wanted to just say two quick things about Bard College Berlin itself, a wonderful institution that I'm very happy and proud to be affiliated with for now 3 years running. One, this event is also being held in conjunction with the Bard College Berlin European Democracy Institute, a wonderful new institution that was launched earlier this year with a mandate to research, debate, and study issues surrounding democracy in the 21st century, and I look forward to collaborating with them and Barrett Ebert more, the co-director of that institute. And also, just a plug and programming note, next week on May 13th and 14th, Bard will be holding a conference called Contemporary Threats to Academic Freedom and Democracy, Education, Journalism, and Human Rights, so very much on similar topics for those who are interested. I'll be appearing, but more importantly, for example, there will be a panel with former Executive Director of Human Rights Watch, Ken Roth, with two UN Special Rapporteurs. So if you're interested in that, you can find all the information on Bard's website. So with that out of the way, I want to fully introduce the guest to my left, Daniel Ziblatt. He is the Eaton Professor of Government at Harvard University and Director of Harvard's Minza de Günzburg Center for European Studies. He also leads a research group on democracy and democratic erosion here at the WZB Berlin Social Sciences Center. I'm sure many of you are familiar with Daniel's writing in places like the New York Times, Foreign Affairs, also as the co-author of two landmark best-selling books on the question of democratic erosion as well as democratic restoration, How Democracies Die, published in 2018, described by The Economist as the most important book of the Trump era, as well as Tyranny of the Minority, published in 2023, both of those co-authored with Stephen Levitsky. He's also a fellow at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the Bavarian Academy of Sciences. And it's a great pleasure to have him in Berlin with us tonight. Thanks, Daniel. Let's see if we can hear you, though.
Hello.
Yes, good.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you.
So I want to start with a level-setting question to go back to some of your own work, read it back to you, and see how it sounds in the light of May 2000. Start with the hard questions. So in a piece with Luke Conway and Stephen Levitsky, common co-authors of yours in Foreign Affairs not long ago, you wrote, "In 2025, the United States ceased to be a full democracy in the way that Canada, Germany, or even Argentina are democracies." You also wrote a column in the New York Times with the same set of co-authors, arguing, quote, "When citizens must think twice about criticizing or opposing the government because they could credibly face government retribution, they no longer live in a full democracy." And you wrote that according to that metric, America was no longer a democracy, at least fitting with that definition, and it had crossed into something else. The something else is what we'll try and discuss and dissect tonight. So what were the key indicators for both of those assessments? What led you to write those words, which sound, on the one hand, quite dramatic, though perhaps at this stage, no one in this room is shocked to hear them. But more important, how do they look and sound now? What's the direction of travel? What would you add or tweak, if anything, to those words?
Yeah, well, first, thank you for having this conversation. Thank you, everybody, for coming. You know, as we wrote, there's three of us, three co-authors, so you can imagine actually we spent a lot of time talking about those precise sentences, so you have a good eye for picking on the things that, you know, were important sentences for those pieces. So one way of thinking about this is that when you live in a democracy, the costs of opposing the government should essentially be close to zero. In other words, not from your peers, you can be criticized by your peers or other members of society, but one shouldn't, if one is engaging in peaceful criticism of a government, one shouldn't fear retribution of the government. And if the costs of being critical or being opposed to a government rise, then you can make statements like the one we did. And the second statement that you read, we wrote in March 2025. And at that particular moment, I guess there's two kinds of evidence that I would point to. First, in these first several months, and this went on through 2025, and I'll come back to the question of what it looks like now, there was a real assault on political opponents of the Trump administration. So you can think of investigations of Adam Schiff, James Comey, this is still ongoing, Letitia James, who's the Attorney General of New York, who are prominent critics of the Trump administration. You know, there's accusations of corruption and all sorts of things. One can always dig up investigations. In many cases, these have gone nowhere. So that's one thing. Prominent critics were politically targeted. A second dimension of where there was a cost of being a critic of the government is seen in the civil society realm. So one can think about media institutions. The Federal Communications Commission opened up investigations of CBS, ABC, NBC, but never Fox News, because Fox News is regarded as being sympathetic. Went after universities, my own university. Universities lost billions of dollars of research funding. And in one major instance of it, Harvard had research money taken away, and eventually a court intervened and said it was being done purely for ideological reasons. So civil society institutions, the state itself, the state has been purged in many ways. I mean, the State Department, the Justice Department, actually there's a political scientist, Adam Bonica, who's done a very close analysis as of November 2025. It's a very precise analysis. He says 9/10 of all civil servants who were fired were working in agencies that have been coded as kind of liberal. So things such as the Environmental Protection Agency, disease protection, you know, disease prevention and sort of things such as this, whereas agencies such as the Veterans Affairs, Defense Department have gotten increases in funding. So the point is, being critical of the government comes at a price. And just a second thing I would say is that second metric is to say that this has changed behavior. And that's another really important metric. I mean, there's a kind of self-silencing, you know, the German phrase of "vor uns allen gehorsam" has really taken place. And one's seen this again over the course of 2025, whether it's media, the change in media stances of major media outlets, the Washington Post. You can look at universities have changed their behavior, their public stances, and a kind of self, a chill, there's been a chilling effect, I would say. So, and that, you know, and that's not to say anything just on personal relations. I mean, you can talk to people. Actually, there was a conversation we were talking about before where Ezra Klein, the prominent New York Times columnist, was interviewing a colleague of yours, Andrew Marantz, who was here, I guess, and he was describing this debate, and Ezra Klein was being a little skeptical, saying, well, you know, I'm on the radio. I can say what I want. I'm not really concerned. And he said, yeah, but do you, you know, they were discussing this argument, and they're saying, well, don't you think twice, though, before what you say? He said, oh, yeah, I do. So, I mean, there is a way that that really speaks to people, the fact that people are having to, you know, change out their cell phones before coming to the U.S., including U.S. citizens. People were nervous. So all of that was 2025. I would say that things are, you asked about what's going on now. I would say things are not as dire now. I mean, what makes elected authoritarians particularly dangerous is when they have 90% approval ratings, let's say like the president of El Salvador or Vladimir Putin, when they have 30% approval ratings, it's in some sense can be less dangerous. And so I think we've begun to see an opening up of things as the balance of power seems to be shifting. So I'm more optimistic now than I was last year, but I would still say that, you know, we don't want to erase this history that we've just lived through over the last year.
But last year you made rather categorical declarations. In other words, you said that America was not a democracy of the type of those other countries that you listed. You also, I believe, in that New York Times article used the word competitive authoritarianism, which is a concept I want to dig into a bit. But you made, qualitative descriptions of American democracy or lack thereof, but you also were making declarations of a rather binary type or kind of placing the U.S. in a different category than it had been before. On that score, what do you think today?
Yeah, I think one of the mistakes that we, I stand by that. I mean, I think that and I'm not alone in this. I mean, if you look at all of the international indices in 2016, the U.S., according to Freedom House, which is perhaps the most conservative of these agencies that code democracies, gave the U.S. a score of 94 out of 100, which put it on par with Great Britain, Germany, Canada. Today it's 81, which puts it below Argentina, with the same score as Jamaica and Suriname. And you know this is a 10-year process. I mean, this is not something that's happened over the last. So there's been a clear degradation of democracy. You know, whether one wants to call it a degraded democracy or competitive authoritarian, I think that the dynamics that we witnessed last year were much more common to a competitive authoritarian regime.
Which are what?
Which are number one, a tilting of the electoral playing field against the opposition, so it makes it harder and harder for the opposition to win. And this, of course, normal politics, incumbents always want to win, and they do everything they can to win. But there's a way in which if you engage in the kind of gerrymandering that we've actually just seen this week allowed by the Supreme Court and taking place across the U.S. right now, when it becomes harder and harder for the opposition to win, then that's one indicator. When you have a weaponization of the state, so then the state's supposed to be a neutral, agency, the regulative agencies of the government, if it's again, you know, to some degree, politicians come in, they fill up the state with their allies. But when it goes down to the level of civil servants are being fired on a mass scale, the state is purged and packed with allies, then that's also a kind of very common strategy. And then finally, I think an interesting dynamic with parallels to Hungary is this transformation of the media landscape. I mean, I think of this as the urbanization of the media, where, journalists aren't arrested, being locked up and so on. But what's happening is the strategy of putting pressure on major media outlets and encouraging allies to buy up these major media outlets to have friendly media, friendly owners buy up. We've seen this with CBS. We're about to see this, I think, in all likelihood with CNN. We've already seen this with Twitter long before the election, as well as potentially TikTok as well. So major American media outlets are now tilted in this way. Now, I want to be clear, though, that there's a lot of strengths in the American system. I mean, I don't think that it's a mistake. There's sort of this, in some ways, the book How Democracies Die is a misleading title,
because it suggests that, you know, you sort of reach a point and you just, everybody goes home and, you know, goes into a deep slumber. But that's really not at all the case, as we've just seen in Hungary. You know, oppositions can win in competitive authoritarian regimes. So if the Democratic Party wins in November, this doesn't suggest that this doesn't mean that the system wasn't unfair. You get, even facing a tilted playing field, an opposition can win, but they just have to win by even more than the incumbent does.
Yeah. You know, one thing that's always interested me in my own study of competitive authoritarian systems, an idea I want to unpack a bit more with you together, is that unlike some of the authoritarian isms of old, one, for example, that existed in this country in the 1930s, that had a much more intrusive, all-encompassing hold on people's lives and was much more disruptive to the daily fabric of life. One of perhaps the advantages, or what allows competitive authoritarianism to be successful, is that it allows for an air of normalcy that to many people, perhaps now this in the second year or second Trump term, that's changed a bit in the US, but still I think you have this resistance to the idea that how can we be living in an authoritarian system or non-democracy? I still go to work. My kids go to school. I meet my friends for brunch on the weekend, right? That this fabric of life doesn't change. It's not disrupted. There's more continuity than not in the way that people just experience their lives. How would you say, how essential is that to our understanding of competitive authoritarianism? How does it also complicate or challenge our diagnostic powers in that there's something fundamentally different going on? You as a political scientist see it, but lay people perhaps have a hard time understanding what it is you're talking about because they think authoritarianism means something akin to National Socialism here or Stalinism, and they're not seeing that, so they can't quite understand what it is you're getting at. Have you found that difficult to parse and explain?
Yeah, I think it's a very good question. I mean, but before I even answer that, I want to say one thing that was sort of interesting about the U.S., more than interesting, really important to understand what happened in 2025, even into 2026. In many ways, the U.S. has taken a darker turn on some dimensions than the standard competitive authoritarian regime. I mean, one of the things that's a hallmark of competitive authoritarian regimes, of Viktor Orban's Hungary, for instance, is its legalism. I mean, it's often following these regimes follow the law, even if they're acting in undemocratic ways. So you can undermine competition in a legal way. What happened over the course of 2025, early 2026, with the shooting of when ICE agents are shooting protesters, peaceful protesters in the streets. I mean, this is a kind of the willingness to use violence against citizens is not part of the competitive authoritarian handbook. So this is something that actually, at least on that dimension, has gone actually beyond competitive authoritarianism.
I remember actually friends of mine from Moscow, activists, journalists, people who've lived through many protests and the crackdown against a protest in the streets of Moscow themselves were shocked because actually, frankly, in all my years of reporting from Russia, no one was ever shot dead by masked agents at a protest in Putin's Russia, which is an interesting thing to ponder.
And so we're sort of in this interesting situation where on the one hand, sometimes it seems like it's the tenor of your first questions, which I think are great and fair questions, you know, we're overstating the threat, but then in some respects, we're also underappreciating the threat. I mean, that if you had asked citizens 10 years ago, and this gets to your question here, you know, put in a box, you know, give me a list of things that if they happen, you would be worried. If you put in on the list of things that happened, armed agents shooting U.S. citizens in the streets for very dubious reasons. And, you know, I have to add, there hasn't been any accountability. We still don't know who these agents were. There's been no accountability for this. So that we're still in that moment. You know, people would say, you know, if you put that in, there would be no debate. You know, you would say, well, that's, you know, if that happened, I would be out in the streets immediately, right? So this gets to your question that there's a way in which, this is one of the elements of it, is that it kind of happens gradually. People are busy. You're engaged with other things in your lives.
And also localized, which makes it different than some of the authoritarianisms of old.
Yeah, and I think the U.S. system is particularly in a way, I mean, it's both a strength and a vulnerability that it's so large. On the one hand, it means, and civil society is highly decentralized. And so, you know, we see all these protests and it doesn't seem like the protests are really big because there's so many of them in small places all around the United States, the No Kings rallies. But these were, you know, you add up the numbers, if this was all in, you know, Paris or Berlin or, you know, in Paris, let's say a highly centralized country, the country would be overwhelmed with the amount of protests. So, but
But to get to your point, I mean, I would say there's two things. One, there's two kind of asymmetries. There's a sort of temporal asymmetry that these things happen over time, and so we don't kind of appreciate the degree to which things are changing. But then there is an asymmetry in terms of who's at the kind of receiving end of this. I mean, most people can go about their lives and be unaffected. And so, you know, when I think of the German scholars who are at Harvard for the year, many of whom were very nervous about coming last year and having second thoughts and delayed their arrival, you know, you speak to them now, they've had a wonderful year. Living in Cambridge, Massachusetts, they don't have any sense of, you know, that the systems, that they're dealing with this stuff on a daily basis. So one can go about one's life in that way. And so it's asymmetric. The people who are receiving it, I mean, when I think of, you know, the Tufts University, so Tufts is right up the street from Harvard, the Tufts University student who was not a U.S. citizen, but was, you know, a student and in the United States legal, who wrote an op-ed that was, you know, slightly critical of Israel. She was swooped up off the streets and arrested and disappeared. So there's other people who are at the receiving ends of this. And that, so that kind of asymmetry is pretty common. I mean, I think actually, and it's not only competitive authoritarian regimes. I mean, I think in many cases, you know, Pinochet's Chile, there may be many ways in which people had normal childhoods and were going about their lives. And so that's not so uncommon. And so it's a mistake. And part of the reason to write books like this and to study history is to understand that just because you're experiencing your daily life, a kind of regular routine, doesn't mean that the system is healthy and thriving.
I want to pick at the word competitive in competitive authoritarianism, because one feature, at least to me, that seems important is that the authoritarians or would-be authoritarians, aspiring authoritarians, actually do have to compete. We'll talk a bit about Trump's return to the presidency, Orban at the beginning. There was this essay, I'm sure you saw it, maybe some in the audience did too, and I'll sort of quote it in a purposely provocative, somewhat devil's advocate way, but the conservative writer, essayist Christopher Caldwell, the piece was really about how the war in Iran marked the end of the Trump project, but he made an interesting, I thought, diagnosis of the beginning of the Trump project. And he called Trump, going back to his first term, but really the second, to be, quote, democratic restoration, a project of democratic restoration, that it was this populist wave, a revolution through the ballot box against a culture of unelected elites in the bureaucracy, academia, culture, and so on. And clearly, there's something to that, right? I mean, Trump won not just the Electoral College, but in 2024, the popular vote. There was, people wanted Trump, and they wanted Trumpism. Now, of course, there's all sorts of surveys that suggest people may be disappointed about what they got. But how to reckon with this fact that there was something within the Trump project that resonated with voters that had majority support. How do we then distinguish between essentially what is democratic, right? That we have to acknowledge that there is actually something democratic about Trump, even as he has anti-democratic impulses, or rather help me understand this paradox of democratic demand for anti-democratic methods. How to make sense of that?
Yeah, so two responses. My first response is to say that to be a Democrat is not simply to engage in, to be a Democratic politician is not simply to engage in elections and win elections. One also has to have a set of criteria about how one behaves once one's in office. And so just having a democratic mandate doesn't mean that once you're in office, you can do anything you want. Clearly, in order to behave as a democratic politician, you have to engage in certain sets of behaviors, or there's certain sets of behaviors you can't engage in. And one is upon taking office, and these are a little bit some of the same categories I used before, where you can't make it so difficult that the opposition really can't win. So you're tilting the playing field again, I'll use that. So it's undermining free and fair competition. And that's usually done, as I said before, by purging and packing a state and regulatory agencies, tax authorities, using the IRS. Actually, as I just came in, I saw that the FBI raided the home of a Virginia politician, a black woman, who, I mentioned her ethnicity only because this seems to be a common target of the Trump administration, who was the one overseeing the Democratic Party's gerrymandering campaign in Virginia. You know, there may be something to go after, but, you know, this using the state to go after political opponents is kind of regular business. So that's the kind of thing where you're
using the state to go after opponents, to tilt the playing field, changing electoral rules, and then also attacking the civil liberties. I mean, this is something we haven't talked about, attacking the civil liberties of citizens. And so, you know, if one's not getting due process, if one's deporting citizens, shooting citizens, I mean, we can't get more basic than that. You know, mistakes happen, but if this happens routinely, these are all criteria by which one can say one's not, as a Democratic politician, it's not engaging in or one is not engaging in politics as a Democratic politician.
But then who are we having the argument with? I acknowledge all of that. And you and I can sit on this stage and we can get together at the Heinrich Böll Foundation, Harvard, all sorts of different places and declare those actions undemocratic. But if there is a Democratic mandate that has in some way led to them, who are we having the argument with, basically, right? Who are we kind of calling out? Or what is rather the vector by which we can effectively reinsert or reestablish some democratic process?
It's because if the shoe were on the other foot and the Democratic Party were doing the same thing to Republicans, it would be unacceptable as well. I mean, one has to have a set of criteria that are rooted in democratic theory. And you might say, well, this is, you know, too highfalutin for normal citizens to understand. I reject that. I mean, there's a basic criteria of fairness and having rights. People want freedoms, want rights. And when these are violated in any way by any party, then they're unacceptable. So I think we can be very clear, and we have to be very clear about those criteria, that it's not just a partisan, especially in a context of high polarization. It's not just because, you know, somebody has a policy limiting migration that you don't like, or somebody has a different view of different policy tax rates or climate issues even. I mean, one, you know, certain issues that we may feel very strongly about, there's certain procedural rules that one has to be committed to if one is going to be considered a Democratic politician. Mm-hmm. Let me just add, though, that, I mean, I know the premise of the question, in some ways, I reject, you know, that it's true that Donald Trump won the popular vote for the presidency, but, you know, he engaged in a lot of this stuff in 2016 without winning the popular vote for the presidency. You know, the court, one of the things that is striking is the Supreme Court, which just has undermined a major voting rights law, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. This was undone by a court, the majority of which was constructed. The judges were appointed by a president, namely Trump, who didn't win a majority of the vote, and confirmed by senators who also didn't represent a majority of the electorate. I mean, so the American political system, so, you know, which that's the way that the world works. But when one says this is a democratic mandate, I mean, we have to be a little cautious here. I mean, this is essential. I think this, the MAGA movement in the United States is a minority movement. It's not a majority movement. Trump won the popular vote for the presidency, fair and square, played by the rules, et cetera. That's all fine. But to give, you know, it's an ambiguous democratic mandate at best, I would say. I mean, the line that I always say, so I have two teenage daughters. I mean, this is just a comment on the constitutional structure of the U.S. You know, the Republicans have won the popular vote for the presidency two times since 1990. So in a German context, we all know what happened in 1990, but my kids, you know, that's not the first thing that comes to mind. I say this is two times, the Donald Trump's won, the Republicans have run the popular vote for the presidency two times since Taylor Swift was born, and yet they've governed half of that time. So we have a system that doesn't, again, that's just how the system works, but we shouldn't, you know, assume like this kind of democratic majority mandate or give too much credence to that when they're not really speaking on behalf of a majority of Americans.
I want to go back to the first part of that your answer, and I wasn't planning on asking such a kind of tactical field level political question, but I thought of it as a Californian myself, we're still registered to vote in California.
Me too. Oh. I'm not registered to vote, but I'm a Californian.
Okay. Yeah.
That's why I wore the white jacket. I was hoping for some nice weather in Berlin, but
So as you know, maybe some in the audience do, we can briefly introduce it, but there was a measure to kind of counter gerrymander in California so that to effectively almost seat for seat try and undo or kind of counterbalance gerrymandering in Texas. And listening to the first part of your answer, I think I heard, and this is what I want to check, that to counter anti-democratic forces, competitive authoritarianisms, those who would erode or degrade democratic principles, that we have to stick to principles and not allow, for example, kind of partisan enthusiasms or partisan allegiances to change our values. They have to remain fixed. So does that suggest that it's not just bad, well, maybe it's good politics, but it's bad kind of strategically for democratic health? If what you really care about is democracy, that the methods of the fight matter, and that, for example, doing your own gerrymandering to cancel out the gerrymandering of the would-be authoritarian may get you some seats or kind of restore a balance in the short tactical period, but is bad, misguided strategy?
Well, that's the argument I made in my book, How Democracies Die, that one shouldn't engage, get in this spiral of retribution. But, you know, I have to say that my view has changed, I mean, as the situation has evolved. Because the thing that has happened, the important thing to understand about this, I mean, this is really getting into the weeds of this, but the redistricting is supposed to happen every 10 years in the United States after the census. The Trump administration put all this pressure on the state of Texas to engage in gerrymandering out of cycle, which is not appropriate. Both parties engage in gerrymandering. That's pretty common. Gerrymandering is not a great thing, but it's in a way when both parties engage in it, no one party has an advantage necessarily. The Democratic Party back in 2021, its first bill that it proposed in the Congress, H.R. 1, House Resolution 1, the very first bill included a national ban on gerrymandering. And I think the Democratic Party continues to be committed to that as a goal. It was defeated by a filibuster in the United States Senate by Republicans. And so now they've engaged in this gerrymandering. And so the question is, how should Democrats respond? And it's a difficult issue. But as with any time you're confronting an authoritarian threat, I would say, you have to make a series of very hard decisions. I mean, a similar kind of question one can ask oneself, you know, facing off against the AFD, like, should one not allow this party into power and form really unnatural coalitions to keep this out? This may sort of be an uncomfortable kind of compromise that one makes, but there's a couple of things that I think make it less bad than it might first appear, the gerrymandering case. Number one, that in California and in other states, they included in this what's called the sunset clause, where because before this period, they'd had this impartial commission. They undid this reform, and there's a sunset clause, meaning that they won't continue to do this. So it's like a one-time thing. And Democrats claim that once they regain the House, that they will then impose a national gerrymandering ban. You know, so I would encourage them to do that. But you know, that from the perspective of the Democratic Party, they argue that if we don't do this, then Republicans will retake the House of Representatives. This will allow President Trump to continue his authoritarian project. And so it's a price that we'll pay with these kind of caveats to make it less costly kind of in terms of democratic theory.
You talked there a bit about tactical compromise. You also mentioned AFD, dilemmas over coalition building inside the tent, outside the tent, what's safer, what's healthier. I want to again read a bit of your own writing to you from a piece from Foreign Affairs. I think it's only appropriate that we read about your take on Weimar Germany, seeing as we're here in the German capital. It's a piece about what Weimar, the lessons of Weimar for not just the United States, but any democracy that is under threat facing would-be or aspiring authoritarian. And you wrote that the mistake of German politicians in the 20s and 30s was, quote, the belief that democracy's protections could be bargained away, but democracy itself could still somehow survive. You went on to write, democracy rarely dies in a single moment. It is chipped away via abdication. Rationalizations and compromises, as those with power and influence tell themselves that yielding just a little ground will keep them safe, or that finding common ground with a disruptor is more practical than standing against him. So that's very resounding, convincing language. A few questions. What does that mean, though? Weimar, especially in hindsight, feels really obvious. I mean, those compromises led to the rise of Hitler, to the Holocaust. Sure, duh, right? I mean, that seems like a set of really clear choices now. But how do we interpret those lessons in a time when the dilemmas of competitive authoritarianism, at least on a kind of case-by-case tactical level, don't feel so dramatic? And also, back to what we talked about a few moments ago, when this disruptor has, at least in part, a democratic mandate to carry out at least some part of his agenda, right? We're talking tonight and have to figure out in practice what part of that agenda has legitimacy to it, what part violates some core principles of democracy that we can reject. And so maybe you can talk about how, okay, I get the general lesson, but how to implement it in messier situations that don't have the clear historical and moral clarity of something like the Third Reich, and also bring it maybe to a German context with a kind of ascendant party that is rising through the democratic system, but perhaps again has these anti-democratic impulses. Where to keep it and what to do with it?
So do you want me to talk about Germany or the U.S. or both or what? Okay.
You're our guest, so okay, take okay. Take where you yeah, well, where
no,
you
I
like.
Mean, I take the point, and that's right. You know, that it is more difficult in the moment to understand the threats, and you know, people living through the period themselves also faced lots of uncertainty. I saw this interview with Hannah Arendt, though, where she says, I mean, it's this striking interview, and she's smoking a cigarette in the interview, and has this her deep, raspy voice, and she's saying, and the interviewer is saying, asking about what her experience was, and she says, you know, it was very obvious what the Nazis were going to do. The thing that shocked me was how my friends responded. That was pretty striking. There was ambiguities at points, and so the question: what do we do in moments of high uncertainty? I think there are no silver bullet answers, unfortunately. But what I think one can do is say that there are historical precedents of compromises and collaborations and acquiescing that have resulted in terrible things, and so one should, at the very least, understand the risks of collaboration. So, you know, there are those who say if you allow an authoritarian into power, they will moderate because they will take the position of responsibility, and that this will tame them in some way. You know, and in theory, I can see how that argument makes sense. And there may even be instances in history of that happening. But there's also lots of instances in history of that not happening. And so, so that's why my advice is, given the uncertainty, I don't think we will. You know, the problem is, in some ways, we won't know until after the fact, until we write the history. But given the risks, it seems to me, one should avoid those risks. I mean, I'm a risk-averse person. I could drink, you know, a couple of glasses of beer and then drive home, maybe, and it might be fine. But that's also risk. You know, I may even do it once and get away with it, but it's risky behavior. And so why, when the potential downsides are so great, why engage in that risky behavior when there are other potential pathways open? That's what I would say. And so, so one can't, I guess, I do a lot of social science where there's a lot of scholars really looking at this question very intensely and seriously to try to understand if you accommodate radical right parties, does this moderate them? Do they, and so one can look at comparative cross-national data. And, you know, and this is what I've spent my time in Berlin studying, in effect. You know, whether one's looking at Austria, the Netherlands, and the thing that I find,
and what's that data show?
Yeah, well, I think the thing that's pretty frustrating is that it's you know, depending on the precise question, it's often ambiguous. I mean, it seems very context specific, and so, you know, it depends on what the nature of the. There's different kinds of radical right parties. There's different kinds of political systems. There are different kinds of compromises. I mean, the research does, if we're looking for a single kind of, okay, this is what you do, that unfortunately, I think the research won't give us that. What the research will tell us is that it's risky. There's a high probability of this backfiring and not working out. And again, if one takes the kind of position that let's avoid risky situations, given the potential downsides of it, that's kind of where I land, I guess.
And I realize you're a political scientist, not a political strategist, but I want to dig in on that point. And let's ground this in Germany, because I think we have an interesting example here with the AfD. Part of their, not the entirety, right, but part of their pitch, part of their identity is as this status quo disrupting power. You know, vote for us because they don't want you to vote for them. That applies to Trump. That applies maybe almost universally, or at least in a common way, to a lot of these movements. And so by keeping them at arm's length, by not coalition building, by not kind of letting them in to the system, or not cooperating with them when they are inside the system, what does that do? You know, is there a danger? I don't know if the data shows this, or your own analysis shows this, but of you're kind of aiding or confirming a core argument, a kind of core raison d'etre of the movement. Look, you know, they won't let us in the system. That's why you, the voters, the public, have to do it. And so is there, does that help or hurt How do you see that playing out?
Yeah, I think that's very possible. I mean, the AFD has continued to rise no matter what strategy gets used, in effect. And so that's, and given the strategy of exclusion, people then say, well, maybe we shouldn't exclude them because look at they're doing so well. On the other hand, we don't know. Had they been included, maybe they'd be doing better. I mean, we don't know what the counterfactual world looks like. I mean, we can kind of assume that, I mean, one can try to make the case, well, had they been included early on, they would have moderated. I mean, we don't know that. I mean, we don't know, you know, what this alternative universe looks like. You know, that's possible, I guess. But it's just, I think the risks are very high. I mean, I'll just report some research that a colleague and I have just finished a paper where we're looking at the effect of Merz when he passed this immigration bill with the support of the AfD in the Bundestag, which was a kind of juncture point. So what we did is we want to know, how did this affect cooperation between other parties and the AfD across Germany and the Kreistag across Germany and the local councils. And one of the things that we see is there's this dramatically, statistically significant increase in the number of proposals of the AfD immediately following this. There's this sudden jump. So that event, that kind of breaking of a norm, seems to have had an effect on the AfD of making them more aggressive, making them more assertive. And so that's the kind of thing that makes me admit that. So that's one bit of evidence. Mm-hmm. You know, that's very narrow evidence. I mean, so it's hard to generalize broadly, but that suggests, you know, accommodation isn't maybe the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things we're looking at now is, what are the content of those bills and proposals? Are they kind of more kind of everyday normal proposals, or are they kind of radicalized, polarizing proposals? Because that would be very interesting. Another bit of evidence that I can report to you from a paper we've written is we look at kind of radical right rhetoric from CDU politicians has on voters' perceptions of the legitimacy of those positions. We find that voters of all stripes tend to think the CDU is more legitimate. So when the CDU makes kind of racist, anti-immigrant kinds of statements, we use social media, used a kind of experimental research design with this, where we showed, where voters saw this, that they are less critical of these stances. And so there's a way in which I think mainstream politicians have a really important role and responsibility in terms of reinforcing democratic norms. And it seems as if the evidence, as you can see from these two studies, suggests that by normalizing this, I think it does open the door.
Mm-hmm. A couple more questions for me, then we'll turn to the audience. So begin to prepare yours. I want to turn back to the US and your book, Tyranny of the Minority, which among other measures calls for expansion in voting access, participants, kind of bring more people into that process. You mentioned a really signal event of recent weeks, Supreme Court ruling that effectively undid the Voting Rights Act, and we're already seeing states take measures to act upon that and to limit voting further. It looks to me like, in a way, tyranny of the minority in microcosm, right? You have a Supreme Court with a majority made up of lifetime appointees who were named to the court by presidents who didn't win the popular vote, confirmed by a Senate, if I understand the math correctly, where senators voting to confirm actually represent less constituents than those who voted not to confirm.
Yeah, and I should say undermining a bill passed by the United States Congress and signed by the president in 1965. Yeah.
Right. They didn't listen to your advice from the book. And the question is, given the levers of power and how they are exercised, then what are the points by which voters, society, minority party can try and reverse these tendencies, you know, other than waiting for a benevolent turn from those who benefit from the outsized power of the minority? Unlikely. Until the minority becomes the majority, what are the levers to achieve some of the mechanisms, and perhaps you can also describe some of them from Tyranny of the Minority, how to counteract or overcome the negative externalities of this minority rule. So what is to be done?
Yeah, so maybe I'll just say, because this relates to Germany as well, is that, you know, I think that the way to understand American populist authoritarianism is that it's not particularly popular. It's just very powerful. And what I mean by that is that it essentially represents the same voting bases in Germany and most West European democracies, 30-35% of the electorate. I mean, Trumpet is, you know, immediately after January 6th had like 30% approval rating. It's like 35% approval rating now. This is, that's the MAGA base is very similar to the equivalent, demographically speaking, sociologically. I mean, our societies are actually much more similar than one might think looking from afar. One may think, you know, how is this guy carrying this out and people aren't opposing him? It's that our institutions are set up in a way to get, when I say that this populist authoritarianism is particularly powerful, it's our institutions are set up in a way to give this voting base, because of the nature of electoral geography, and people are based in rural areas, and rural areas are overrepresented in the Senate and in the Electoral College, and as a result, the Supreme Court. These forces, just a sort of accident of electoral geography, have more power in the United States, institutional power, and it's because of the design of our institutions. So the goal in our book was to really try to make the case for why, you know, that America over the last, you know, several centuries, 250 years. Much of what we love about the U.S. Constitution is not what was written at the founding moment, but many of the institutional reforms that have come since, the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery, the 14th Amendment, which introduced for the very first time the word equality into the Constitution, 15th Amendment guaranteeing voting rights. And so, then in the 20th century, there was this big push for constitutional reforms, rapid succession of constitutional amendments. And really, since the 1970s, that tradition has stopped. And so we have this frozen constitution that is too difficult. I mean, constitutions should be hard to change, as I'm sure you would agree. But on the other hand, they shouldn't be so difficult to change that they're frozen. And that's the system that we're in today. So in the book, we propose a series of constitutional reforms that are basically impossible to implement, abolish the Electoral College. The U.S. is the only system in the world with an electoral college for selecting presidents. But there are things that can be done. And I think, you know, it depends very much. And so you're saying before the next election, or are you saying?
I'm not giving it necessarily a time frame, but give us the non-impossible list.
So there's certain things legislatively that can be done. I mean, the Voting Rights Act was something that was transformed American politics, that was a effect almost like a constitutional change that was passed through the legislature, Congress, and signed by the president. I think the court is the major. I think what Democrats should be thinking about right now is not only being opposed to Trump, but should be thinking about ways of reforming the court system. You know, whether that means changing the way that judges are appointed, changing the way that there's a kind of the old model where the federal judges they're called circuit court judges because they rode circuit, which meant they were in different places and they would sit on the Supreme Court. The idea that you can know who's on the court, you design the cases strategically to know who's going to be on the court because they're going to be there for the next 30 years. And you kind of work your way up through the system with a case, knowing who you're going to appeal to. The cases are designed to appeal to particular judges is madness. And so I think there should be much more uncertainty, for instance, about who's sitting on the court. So that would be one kind of proposal. So I think that's something that may be difficult, but there, you know, there's growing sense at some level of Congress actually has some regulative capacity over the court constitutionally. That's one thing. I could go on all night with these, but I'll stop with just two other really interesting ideas. One is the size of the House of Representatives. I know in Germany, people are upset about the Bundestag is too big. In the US, we've had the same size Congress since 1929. Despite the fact that the populations, you know, increase massively. And so that tends to actually overrepresent rural areas, that the Congress used to update its size every 10 years. I think that's something that doesn't require constitutional change. And I think broadly, I'll just end with this one, is that, you know, and there's growing movements for electoral reform. So we have the first past the post system, like Britain, like Canada, and there's real efforts at the state level, which is how most reform, I mean, the way reform happens in the U.S. is bottom up and top down at the same time. I mean, these movements can go from below, introducing forms of proportional representation, which, and there are growing movements across U.S. states to do that. So that's something that I think would make a major difference.
I want to close, at least my portion, by asking about Hungary. It feels important to talk about, because for so many years, Orbán's rule was held up as the model, the kind of competitive authoritarian system. My colleague Andrew Marantz traveled to Hungary many times to study Orbánism as a way of trying to study what Trumpism might hold. And I wonder if now, in Orban's defeat and the victory of Peter Magyar, if there's also some allegorical lesson that we should seize on. You, and this also harkens back to remarks you made at the very beginning of our talk when you said that actually, if I understood you correctly, there's a kind of a bit of a positive trend line in the U.S., first and foremost stemming from Trump's lack of popularity, which is something or the thing that ultimately undid Orban as well. So I just wonder if there's something replicable, not in a kind of campaign strategy sense, but more in a health of democracy sense from Hungary. Are there some things we should pay attention to in Orban's defeat, just like we paid so much attention to how Orban constructed his state? Should we also be paying attention to how his rule eventually came apart?
Yeah, I think there's lessons not to learn and there's lessons to learn. One of the lessons not to learn, which is something that was very prevalent immediately after the election in the U.S. political debate, especially among conservatives, was to say, well, the fact that he lost shows you the system wasn't authoritarian to begin with. And like in the next step of logic, which suggests that maybe the U.S. is actually fine, too.
Well, he acknowledged his loss, which all, he already has one up on his U.S. counterpart.
That's right. So that's true. But you know, even so, even admitting a loss and losing, I mean, the example I often think of is there was this famous story of a boxer who put lead in his gloves to cheat, and he still lost the match. That didn't mean he wasn't cheating. I mean, so you can tilt the playing field and still lose. And so I think it's a mistake to think, well, aha, maybe this wasn't so bad, because it understates all of the things that we've talked about, the ways in which the system was told. So that's a lesson not to learn. I would say there's a couple of lessons to learn. One lesson to learn is that, you know, especially for the left, I would say the center left, is that these broad coalitions can work. I mean, the fact that the Democratic opposition gathered essentially in one force was essential. I mean, when you're playing on an uneven playing field, then you have to win by even bigger majorities, and you have to be more cohesive, which makes it that much harder because of the infighting. The broader the coalition, the more heterogeneous the coalition. The more heterogeneous the coalition, the more people dislike each other. And so holding these broad coalitions together is very difficult. A final lesson I would say is that that the center right has sort of two faces to it. I mean, for many years, the German CDU and the center right in Europe turned a blind eye and, in fact, benefited from Orban at the level of the European Parliament. But it's when they turned away from Orban that there's a way, and you got the emergence of a kind of different kind of center right. I think the center right can play a productive role in democratic politics. And so the center right is a pivotal actor.
I want to ask one follow up to that, which is in the US case, we've seen that democratic values are actually not all that popular in terms of driving voter behavior. It's not something voters tell pollsters or go into the voting booth and decide upon. And I don't actually know enough about the ins and outs of the latest Hungarian campaign to say conclusively what happened there. I know that corruption and evidence of almost, you know, tragicomic levels of corruption in and around Orban's inner circle was quite decisive. What do you think about the notion of, well, in the U.S. case, you know, why democracy is not actually all that motivating for voters, and whether what the case was in Hungary, and sort of what that also means for how to make this pitch to voters, to society at large? Because it seems like when you tell them, hey, this election, it's really about the future of democracy. The stakes are huge. It's, do we have a democratic system? Does democracy either survive or return as restored? People don't necessarily care about that as much as we'd think they should.
Yeah, well, I think that these kinds of regimes have an Achilles heel. That is the Trump regime, the Orban regime, which is that they rely on their connections to business elites and oligarchs. That's part of their source of their strength, but it's also a vulnerability. And because it gives rise to accusations of corruption, it gives rise to corruption, and it gives rise to accusations of corruption. And so I think another final lesson I would say then is that corruption is a mobilizing issue of citizens against authoritarianism. And because the authoritarianism, the corruption, in this case, at least in this kind of patrimonial kind of regime, are very closely connected. And so one can, the price of authoritarianism in effect is this kind of massive corruption. And so that's a very useful target, a mobilizing issue for voters.
You have been listening to the Europa podcast and the episode of Talking Europe series. That was the recording of Democracy in Danger, an evening with Daniel Sieblatt, held on May 6, 2026 at the Heinrich Böll Foundation in Berlin, in cooperation with Bard College Berlin. Many thanks to Eva van der Ragt, Joshua Jaffa, Daniel Sieblatt, the Heinrich Böll Foundation, Bard College Berlin, and everyone involved in making this event and recording possible. My name is Manuel. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the Europa Podcast, recommend it to others, and visit us at europapodcast.de. See you next time on Talking Europe.
Talking Europe.
Talking Europe.
Talking Europe.
Talking Europe.
Talking Europe. Talking Europe. A podcast by the European Democracy Institute in collaboration with Europa Podcast.